This is Project, the podcast that follows ideas from their inception to their reality. Anduya, saucy sesh, saucy son sec, coppa. These are all cured pork-based products. And with that in mind, it would be safe to assume that this episode would take us to the continent. However, featured today is one of the best charcuterie producers in the UK. Having learnt French, travelled Africa, found himself in southwest France, and returned to Liverpool, Andy of North by Sudwest has developed an award-winning approach to charcuterie, producing from the unlikely location of a converted spray shop in Bootle. Covered in the podcast is how Andy's approach to learning French has allowed him to create an exceptional product, and how having an exceptional product translates to business. However, first we need to understand why Andy makes charcuterie.
For me, what I wanted to do with this business was copy the way that they do things in these small places on the continent. Doesn't matter whether it's France, Spain, Italy, Germany, where you've got a person who's developed a lot of knowledge and who knows how to do something their way. And as a result, the thing that they make is different to the thing that someone else makes. It's basically the same, but because it's a different person who's making it with various different subtle differences of how they do things, it tastes of itself. They talk about terroir or whatever, which is a Ponzi word to say that it's about the place where it comes from. Well, the terroir of Bootle is arguable, but actually the stuff that I make does have local terroir because the pigs come from round the corner where, like, when you're living in Liverpool, it feels like there's no countryside anywhere nearby, but actually you only need to go across the river. On the Wirral, there's loads of countryside and there's quite a lot of farms. And then in Cheshire, there's loads of countryside and there's quite a lot of farms. And quite a lot of those farms, because they're small and not especially visible, you wouldn't know that they were there, but they are. And they're really high quality. They've got people who are really enthusiastic about looking after their animals properly and they care about the product that they're making and the animals that they're sort of looking after. And so those things are an amazing resource that we in this country quite well placed in terms of, lots of the meat that gets produced in this country is amongst the best meat in the world because of those small farmers. And there is a culture of that kind of thing. A lot of the stuff in other countries is done a bit more on large scale. But then again, what I'm trying to copy is the people who do it well in France and Spain and whatever, and they're not bothering with the same products that factories bother with. They're getting the good gear, the local gear, and they're making it the local way using sort of traditional, simple, tasty, unpretentious ingredients and making some proper delicacies, you know.
So why do you want to make proper delicacies around here? You said there's only a few people doing it the way you do in the UK.
Yeah.
Why do you want to be one of those people?
Because I find it interesting is the short answer. And like I wanted to find a job where I was doing something for myself that had some future in it. Because I felt like when you're working in a restaurant, even if you're head chef or whatever, you basically just get paid a wage, you absolutely bust your ass, and then the person who makes the money, if they're lucky, is the owner, and you don't see any of it. You get your crappy wage, and then you get expected to kill yourself for it. You don't get chefs who are older than 50 unless they're the kind of chefs who just sort of swan around and tell people to put a bit of chervil on top of this or whatever, and talk about provenance to the media. Well, I didn't want to be that, and I knew that I wasn't sort of confident enough to become one of those people anyway. But I also didn't want to open my own restaurant because I just thought that I would just end up burying myself in it and never see my family working every single night. And then you've got quite a small chance of actually making any money because it's hard, you know? So I thought in my infinite wisdom that I could do something like this, but I could do specifically this that would be a day job, and that would sort of set me up for to have some kind of a future. And I wanted to do something that I was interested in, and this is what I was interested in. The reason why I started making pigs and pig stuff in this country is because I fancied the idea of doing of keeping some pigs and for the family, you know, like two pigs and then killing those two pigs after a year and then using that meat to feed the family for the best part of a year. And then that fell through, nothing happened, but I still wanted to do the pig thing. And so I, instead of buying a live one, I bought a whole dead one from a butcher contact that I had. And I did it in my kitchen with the back door open in the winter. I didn't have any big walk-in fridges or anything. I mean, I was working in a restaurant, so I did have access to a little bit of help. But basically, yeah, it was like, you know, 2 degrees outside, open the door wide open, put a hat on, and then have everybody else get cold whilst I'm doing all this stuff and mincing an entire pig using a KitchenAid attachment thing. You know, you can get a little mincer that attaches to your KitchenAid. That was my mincer. And that was my sausage stuffer as well. That stuff got put in my mum and dad's garage. I didn't have any chambers. You can make yourself one out of a fridge, but that costs money. The whole point of it was to not spend money. It was to sort of do something that was economic and cool, but not like self-indulgent in a way of like, oh, I'm going to buy myself something expensive. So I didn't buy any equipment. I just did it without. And so I did it at the right time of the year, the traditional time of year. And so the sausages went into my mum and dad's garage. Like, we fermented them. You were talking about fermenting sausages at 20 degrees earlier. We just put them in a room with the heating on for 3 days and, you know, a temperature gauge next to them so we knew it was about right. And, like, I remember we had, you know, one of those wipeable tablecloths on the floor underneath all these, like, poles so that any drips of sausage juice or whatever didn't go in the carpet. Yeah, and then those, like, I was amazed that they turned out really well, you know? Like, I was a bit shy about it, and I was like, yeah, it's all right. And then, also, out of an entire pig, you make loads, you know? Like, you've seen how much you make. Like, out of a gigantic pig like that one, you can make over 100 kilos of product. Well, this was probably less than half size. Well, it was definitely less than half size, about 100 kilos, I think. And so I probably still made, like, 40 kilos of stuff at least. And so it's like, well, what do you do with all these sausages? There's only so many sausages you can eat as a family. No one tells you about when they're saying, oh yeah, you should process this for the family. It's like, they'll go off. They'll go too hard before you can eat them all, especially if you've not got a backpack machine, which I didn't. So I was like, oh, I'm trying to flog these sausages under the counter, you know, to anyone who wants them. And so I did. I sold them to a local restaurant. And I had my friend who was a rep for a meat company. He was like, oh, I'll give some of these to some people and whatever. And he gave some to this fancy Dan chef. Tasted it, apparently, because, you know, the meat rep guy, he goes to lots of different restaurants in the region. And so he's like, oh, taste this, my mate Andy's done this. And apparently, I don't know if this is true, he came back and told me that this guy said it was the best charcuterie he'd ever tasted. And I was like, that's bollocks. But it's still nice. You know, like even if he's being nice, oh, fucking hell. You know, so, like, I wasn't confident enough to believe that. But nevertheless, I remembered it. And so it just made you think, oh, yeah, but it is nice, I suppose. And it sort of went from there. You know, like, literally the stuff was hanging with a bike underneath it and stuff, that one of the hams took like 18 months or something. It spent 18 months in my mum and dad's garage. And then when we cracked it open, it was amazing. And I was expecting it to be terrible, you know, like, this thing's not being done right, you know. And you crack it open, it's like, fuck. It's like seriously proper good, but you don't find out for like 2 years. And I did also make some other hams and they didn't quite work. But the first time I did one in the style that I do it here, I was like, that one spent a year and a half in my mum and dad's garage. And it was just, it was mind-blowingly good. I was like, at first you taste it and you go, oh, I must be just imagining that it's good because I want it to be good. And then you get other people to taste it, and then you sort of like have a bit of cooling off period or whatever, and then taste it again. Actually, it genuinely is like exceptionally good. And that was kind of exciting, you know, and gives you a bit of confidence. Can you do it again? But then you have to wait another 18 months to find out if you can do it again, because I only made one because it was quite a big risk that it might not work. And so I assumed it wouldn't. So I made one, waited a year and a half, and then go, oh, okay, I can make some more. And now I do it now every time I make at least one of those hams. Yeah, yeah. That's the kind of how it developed. It started off as me just doing something that I was interested in because I thought it was cool. I like cooking. It's just cooking. It's just dead slow cooking. I'm never going to run out of something to say when it's talking about food and cooking and this, that, and the other. It doesn't have to be charcuterie. It can be fish and dessert. Like, I'm sort of a... I haven't talked about it, but most of my career around what I've been talking about today has been spent as a pastry chef. And, like, I'm sort of professionally interested in that more than I am, like, personally enthusiastic about eating cake. Like, I can take it or leave it, you know? But I do like good ones, and I like things that are being done well. And, you know, I know how to make the best lemon tart. I know how to make the best creme brulee and the best chocolate mousse. Like, the simple things, that's what I like. Simple classic things. The reason why they're classics is because if you do it right, and that's an important thing, then they're the best thing ever, you know. But most people don't. Most people can't be arsed. Most people cut corners because it's either cheaper that way or faster that way, and they're lazy. Or quite importantly, the customers don't recognize how good it is because they're used to having the shit version of it that comes from a supermarket, and so it doesn't sell. And that's the story of my career. Do you know what I mean? Like, you make something that you're super proud of. It's like, oh, this is like dead simple and like whatever. And then it's like just sits there, and like you sell like two in a week, and you're like, oh, but that was the best thing ever. But because the customers, it has to be in the right room to sell something like that. And so if you go to St. John in London, that simple food is in the right room, and it's like the whole restaurant is geared to, is set up properly so that people understand that what you're going to get is super simple but really quite thoughtful French British cooking, but it looks super simple, and then you taste it and it's like amazing, and it's using really sort of unfancy ingredients, lots of offal and stuff. That's one of their big things, and they're like an institution. They've been going for years and years and years and years, and the guy, the chef owner Fergus Henson, is like definitely one of my all-time heroes.
So, that's why some of the best charcuterie in the country is produced in Bootle. Easy access to top-quality pork, and a man who has a passion for doing things well. So far, the key to Andy's success seems to be this theme of doing things well. Where did this come from for Andy?
What sort of things motivated you?
I mean, like, I learned to play the guitar quietly on my own without any help, and that takes quite a lot of dedication, I suppose. Well, my dad plays the guitar, and so he had some guitars, and he bought himself a couple of electric guitars, and that was the sort of spur for me to be able to learn it, not because I wanted to play electric guitar especially, but because I could play an electric guitar without anyone being able to hear me. Do you know what I mean? You don't need to plug it in. It makes enough noise for you to be able to hear what you're doing, but the person in the next room can't. And so that was what I needed because I wasn't confident to do it. I needed to just be able to do it on my own without anybody coming in and telling me that I was shite or laughing at me, skitting me, you know. But that's, I guess, something that I did quite assiduously and carefully. And, you know, like, I don't know, at school, I was good at some things. And, I mean, I was all right at most things, but I was quite prepared to do the bare minimum, you know. And like I liked flying on the seat of my pants a little bit. And when I was at school, I did A-level French. I was quite good at French. I did a French degree, and that's why I went and worked in France, and that's why I'm a charcuterie guy, I suppose. When I was at school, we were set various homework things, you know, A-level, and it was quite hard homework. You had to read a book and then answer loads of questions on, you know, like a novel or whatever. And the way our teacher did it, he was very thorough and organised. He was a brilliant sort of inspirational teacher. And he did like worksheets of, you know, page 7, seven questions on page seven, and then page eight, seven questions on page eight about all these, and you had to answer it in French, whatever. Well, we'd get to the lesson, and I hadn't read it. But what I would be doing is, as they were going through the answers in the class, he'd ask one person at a time, and then the person next to them would get asked, and then the person next to them would get asked. So you'd be able to go, I'm going to be. So I'd be reading the right-hand side page for the first time whilst they were going over the answers of the left-hand side page. And then I would get my answer and I wouldn't fuck it up. And so there was that sort of training, but that was through pure laziness, but also because I like the idea, I suppose, of just being able to do it without cheating. Does that make sense? Even though it was cheating. But that was my idea of cheating. Like, I like to be able to do it properly. I think it was good training for thinking on your feet, and it made me quite good at speaking French. I lived in Paris for a year at university, which I loved. You realise that the French-speaking world isn't just France. And so there's all North Africans, particularly North Africans and West Africans in France. And they talk with crazy accents and they're quite hard to understand. And I was like, wow, it'd be interesting to go to all the places where they speak French in the world. And so I decided that was my ambition for life, to go to North and West Africa. And so I finished my degree course and got a 2-2, gentleman's degree. Because, as I say, I didn't do any work for the first 2 years. And the third year, I worked quite hard. Or rather, the fourth year. I did that. I had a lovely time. And then the following year, I did some crap jobs. Worked for the Home Office for quite a long time. As a temp, you know. Saved up some money. And then that was me. I went off. A couple of mates came with me One guy came for 1 week, for 2 weeks. And then another guy came for 6 weeks while we were in Morocco. Yeah, so we travelled around Morocco. And then my friend went north. I think he went to, like, Norway or somewhere, you know, like that. And I went south. I went to Mauritania, which I'd never even heard of before I started researching this trip. And I travelled through Mauritania, which is a place where they had slaves still. Supposedly, I never saw any evidence of it. And it was an amazing, scary, intimidating prospect, but an amazing reality. And then I went into Senegal and Burkina Faso and, Mali, Burkina Faso and Ghana and Togo and Benin. And I eventually flew home from Ghana. I spent like 4 months doing that. I wanted to do this thing that was a bit different to what everyone else did. And it was a lot harder than what everyone else did. And I did it. And then I remember on the way home and then going, oh, I've done my ambition now. I was a bit like, oh, what am I supposed to do now? Yeah, it was interesting because that was the only thing I'd ever thought that I wanted to do in my life. And I'd done it. And then I was a bit sort of, and I eventually became, kicked around doing a few more crappy jobs and then got fed up of it and decided to become a chef because I wanted to do something that I liked as opposed to, and so then I became a chef. Just got a job in a local restaurant and took it from there. So all these things, I suppose, are examples of me doing things sort of at my own rhythm. Not necessarily looking for someone to teach me how to do it.
Teaching himself guitar, flying by the seat of his pants in French, and travelling where others generally don't, are all fiercely individualistic. This inclination to do things well has spawned as a result of this self-motivation. However, before he could apply himself to charcuterie, he first had to learn how to make it.
You know, to be honest, most of my career as a chef, I was deeply intimidated. He won't go in, and then we went and lived in France for 4 years, and that was, again, something that we just, we sorted out ourselves. We didn't sort of, I didn't have like an uncle figure sort of chef with his arm around my shoulder saying, oh, I'll send you to this place where there's a guy that I know. My wife got a job. She's a primary school teacher. She was. She got a job for an international school. And we'd thought that we kind of fancied the idea of going and living in France, both of us, which was a nice surprise, you know, which showed how compatible we were, I suppose. And then when she got that, she like found this job, applied for it, and then we were like, they give me an interview. Are we going to go and live in this place called Pau that we've never heard of? And we were like, it's in the southwest of France. I mean, we can go to the interview. So I came along as well we got on a plane and went to this interview, and the idea was that we would decide over the space of 2 days or whatever that we were there whether or not we fancied living in this town in the southwest of France. And she got given the job, and then it was like we went out for a meal and we're like, so are we going to do this then or what? And it was like, well, fuck it, yeah. And so we did it. And then that summer, the end of the summer, we packed all our worldly possessions into a trailer and drove in our Ford Fiesta to the southwest of France. And then at first we lived in a tent and for about 2 weeks while we were looking for somewhere to live. And then we found somewhere to live that was amazing. It was like by the chateau. If anyone's ever been to Po, it's like, it's a nice place. It's quite chichi. And it's got a very famous medieval chateau. And we stayed there for 4 years. And the charcuterie that I worked for in France, that was a job that I just got on spec. Like I went to the job centre, you know, because I could speak French. I was in the position to be able to just, well, do whatever a French person would do. Except for that, obviously, not being French meant it was more intimidating. And so I got a job working for a fairly majorly psychopathic French charcuterie guy because I wanted to do a job that meant that I wasn't working at nights because otherwise what would be the point of going to live in France with my wife who also didn't speak French? She didn't speak a word of it when we arrived. And so I didn't want to just abandon her and like work 80 hours a week. So instead I was like, well, charcuterie, that sounds good because it's cool. It's something that they do in that part of the world and it'll be a day job. So that's where it's come from, yeah.
And did he take to it straight away or?
Well, it's mainly, to be honest, it was mainly a chef's job, like cooking. So in France, the charcuteries, they tend to be charcuterie traiteur, and that means someone who makes charcuterie, but also a caterer. So like outside catering and also like a posh deli. So at least the one I worked in was quite posh. It was a good one to fall into. I got that job pretty much straight away, and then it started like, I don't know, a month or so later. And in the meantime, I worked for some other guy just as a sort of a temporary basis because I had this job waiting for me. And so I worked for two different places, two different charcuteries, as it turned out. And the one that I was there for a long time, I was actually more interesting, more characterful, definitely less, more family run and smaller. What we were mainly doing was just chef type cooking, but we would also make black pudding. We made like the best black pudding I've ever tasted out of fresh pig's blood. And the father of the owner who'd set the business up himself, you know, like 30 or 40 years ago or whatever, 50 years ago, he was mates with the guy from the abattoir. So he was the only person who didn't work in the abattoir who was allowed inside the abattoir. And he would go and get a massive, you know, like I never know what the word is for it. The big milk containers that you get, the big sort of metal milk containers with the two handles on either side, like a milk churn or something like that. And we would get one of them, about a meter tall, full of fresh pig's blood. And then the next day, like, so that's on the day that the pigs had been killed. And then the next day we would make black pudding, and that's how it had to work. So every Wednesday we made black pudding. Every Tuesday you went to the abattoir. Now, I would love to do that in this country. I'd love to do it. We used to process our own. I mentioned it before. We used to process the intestines ourselves because it was cheaper, basically, and better, more flavoursome because they were a bit more stinky, you know? And it's just the way the French look at these things. Oh, it's more stinky, therefore it's better. And anyway, and so we made this black pudding. It was like actually amazing, like genuinely the nicest black pudding I've ever had. I know how to make it, but to make it in this country commercially, I don't think I'll ever be able to because of the legislation that needs to, the hoops that are there to jump through. Whereas in France, they just ignored the legislation. Because it was something they'd been doing in that part of the world for hundreds of years, and they hadn't changed it, and it was perfect, and it was delicious and safe as ours is because they didn't. We were talking about earlier about the legislation instead of people just taking responsibility. Well, the culture is such that the responsibility is just automatically taken because they just know it's ingrained in them that you've got 2 days to use that blood maximum. So you're best using it on the day on within 24 hours. So we just used it within 24 hours every time, like with no exceptions. But what you're actually supposed to do is have the blood. This is a bit gruesome. Is that okay to me, for me to talk about something that's a bit gruesome?
Go for it.
Because it's blood, and some people don't like blood. But so when they kill a pig, they drain the blood out, so they slit the throat or whatever. And what they would do in practice is they would put a bucket underneath the pig and collect it. It would drip in. They would collect it, and then it would get put into our container, and then we would take it and put it in the fridge with a big thing of salt in it. Someone would stir it to get rid of the coagulants, so the things that make it set up. So if you stir it, then the coagulants all come in sort of like ribbons, and then you can take out those coagulants, and then you've got liquid blood that won't set. And so someone was doing that at the abattoir, clearly. I never saw it done. And then we would put it in the fridge with a big handful of salt in it, which helped to preserve it a little bit. And also it's going to help in, that's part of the seasoning later on of the dish. I had a French guy explain to me what the actual legislation is to do it like properly. So if you wanted to sell it on a large commercial basis, what you need to do is have a special machine that literally takes, like a pipe that takes the blood directly from the artery of the pig that they're going to cut. And then it goes directly into a machine which churns it, takes the coagulants out and cools it at the same time, and then put that into a refrigerated container. And then it needs to be moved in a refrigerated van, and everything needs to be done very quickly. Of course, it was the same as what we did, but it all needs to be, you know, temperature checked, and there needs to be a check here and a check here and a check here. And then when it arrives, you need to check the temperature, and then you need to use it really quickly. And in order to have that infrastructure, does exist in France if you've got a bit of heft behind your business. And I know a guy in France who does do that, who's a friend of my old boss's, and he's the guy who explained it to me, a guy called Eric Hopital. And in this country, there is no infrastructure for that. The only black pudding that gets made in this country with fresh pig's blood is by a couple of guys in Norwich, and they became slaughtermen in order to be able to make fresh pig's black pudding. Like, I mean, that's dedication. That is, I don't quite have that level of dedication. It's a dangerous, horrible job. But there's lots of things that I can be a bit fussy about. And it's like, well, that could be good, but it's not good because it's not being done right. And I like to do things as right as I can. This doesn't mean to say I don't make mistakes and I don't fuck things up. Like, definitely do, and like, neither does it mean to say that I'm like some kind of master. Like, I just I think I know my what I'm good at. I don't know, like, I don't want to make myself sound like I'm a know-it-all or whatever. Like, I just think that you don't need to be that talented to do something really good. You just need to be asked to do it. You need to be motivated, and then just do everything correctly and taste. And that's the talent, I guess, tasting. But when you're making charcuterie, the tasting happens so long after you make it that it's quite a technical way of making sure that it's right and whatever. But I've done that now, and that's sort of, I've got that down. And it's only a question of making sure you get all the different technical bits right. But they're not things that take extreme skill. They are things that take conscientiousness, you know? So I think that's what I'm quite good at, being conscientious.
Fuck it. So that was the start of Andy's charcuterie career. And once again, this idea of doing things properly recurs. And by chance, Andy happened upon a charcuterie that reflected his values and followed their own rules. However, Andy worked in an established business. Once back in Liverpool, he had to establish himself. How did North by Southwest come from hanging hams in his parents' garage?
And you were saying earlier that this became your livelihood, sort of during and post-lockdown.
Yeah.
But at what point was it like, this pig thing that I'm doing, actually, this is going to be my job now?
Lockdown. Because I was able to sell it. Because prior to that, I'd been making stuff and I'd entered some competitions. There was a British Cured Meats Award that I won a couple of medals on. And that gave rise to me getting an order from the guy who ran that competition, who had a cured meat company distributor. I think it was like a charcuterie club where you get sent something every month, you know, or every couple of months or whatever. And he was like, oh, I'll book you in for I don't know, November or something, 2019. I need like 100 of this and 100 of that, or 200 of, I can't remember what it was, but like it, for me, it was a gigantic order. And I remember I had to do an entire big pig just in sausages just for that order. And for at the time, that was like, it was a different way of working. And so I made everything up. I branded it. It was all ready to go. And then he was like, oh, we've had a delay, so it's going to have to be, we're going to have to put it back by a month. So then it was December, and then it was January, and then it was, and I was like, well, that's fine, you know, like, because it just gives me a bit more time to make sure everything's exactly as it wants to. And there's a long shelf life on these things. And then I think it was supposed to be March, and then we're talking about March 2020. And then lockdown happened, and I was phoning them saying, are you going to, like, when am I sending you this stuff, you know, like, and then they stopped answering the phone. And then I eventually, after like phoning them incessantly, got someone to say, oh, I think the company's folded yesterday or today or something. And I was like, oh, okay. Now I've got all this stuff. What do I do with it? And like I say, it was literally at the start of lockdown. So I probably found out in the first week of lockdown while I was off sick. Well, maybe before lockdown, but like, you know, when it was just starting to happen, I remember I took 2 weeks off because I thought I might have COVID, because there's no way of telling at the time. Remember, like, you couldn't test. So if you had the snivels, you were like, well, I better not go to work. And then from that point onwards, whilst everyone else was locked down in their house, I was all of a sudden a key worker, and I worked my ass off. So like I had this like massive amount of meat that, I needed to sell, and so I did, and I went driving around and to various different places, dropping it off to people and people's doorsteps and stuff that we were talking about before. And I think that after I managed to do that and make some money out of it, I was like, well, I might be able to make this into my job instead of busting my ass for someone else. And then they got made redundant, and then I was thinking, oh, well, when I was made redundant, I kind of wanted to go part-time anyway. I was plucking up the courage to ask my boss, can I just go to 3 days a week, which I knew he wouldn't have looked on very kindly, but actually he looked on it super kindly by sacking me. And so the because I was the most highly paid member of staff, and so they did that. And I was like, well, that's fine. I understood the motivation behind that totally. They were worried about their business, and I was kind of like, well, good luck. And then I got a phone call for that. I remember I was in the butcher's shop working, doing something. And he phoned me up, told me that I'd been made redundant, strictly illegal, but I didn't mind that at all. I put the phone down and I went to the butcher and I was like, oh, so I've just lost my job. And he was like, oh, oh, that's a shame. Well, you know, Emma, who works in the adjoining delicatessen to the butcher's shop, you never know, she might be, you know, interested in having someone like you. And I was like, okay. So then I went and spoke to the girl who ran the adjoining delicatessen. You could walk from the back of the butcher shop to the back of the delicatessen. It was all the same building. And then we had a 5 minute conversation, and then I got a job. Do you know what I mean? Like literally I'd been sacked for, you know, less than an hour, and then I had a new job, and it was more on the terms that I was used to, that I was interested in. It was 3 days a week, and it was in the place where I was doing my work that I was interested in as well. So it was just perfect. Like, everything about lockdown was great for me, except for the fact that I didn't get to have a rest because I was busting my ass all the time. And everyone talks about the trauma of lockdown and how it sort of turned their lives upside down. But it did do that to us, but in a way that all we did was just work. And I haven't really come out of that since, to be honest.
Through a twist of fate, Andy finds himself back in a French lesson, having to fly on the seat of his pants to sell his first large order. A skill Andy seems uniquely good at, having been able to apply it to all of his endeavours. Whilst this is a great tool when starting a project, it's hard to maintain, as you're constantly at the limit, sprinting at full pelt. And it seems as though Andy doesn't really have a way of coming out of this. Does Andy plan on a change of pace? Or will he burn out?
So you wanted to do this because this had more of a future than being a chef and working for someone else.
Mm.
But this surely isn't sustainable. The the amount of work you're doing, and you want to turn your business into something more like the next category of food producer. So what is the future?
Don't know. I don't know. Like, it's, I think you've made a correct assertion that it's surely not sustainable. That's just the reality.
Have you considered that?
Of course. Yeah. But you don't know until you find out. So that is the reality of it. So it's like, what I do, yeah, it's really good, but it doesn't make very much money. But I work constantly. There's one argument is, well, you've got to work hard if you want to get to the stage where you can start making some money. And I'm sort of in that phase now. But there's also the reality is like, well, if I'm carrying on making, you know, like we said, a ton and a half of product a year and still not making any money, except for to keep the wolf from the door, then it's not a future, is it? So either the business has to develop, I have to start doing something different with it, or invest or something. I absolutely am aware of what you just said, and like it's in my thoughts. But then, you know, like if I wanted to close the business down, that's not even straightforward. I couldn't just walk out the door. There's thousands of pounds worth of product in there that's not ready yet. It's a tricky one. Like, you know, I can imagine someone listening to this would think, what an idiot, you know, and like, I'd struggle to disagree. Honestly, because I'm not soft, but, you know, but equally I'm in it and I've got to do it. And so you do it. You know, I've got a lease on this place. My plan is to get close to the end of the lease, and at that stage I'll make a decision. Either I've made progress so as to start making more money. I mean, Christmas is like a really critical period. Like, so we're in November now, and November and December are the 2 months where, especially in the markets, that I do farmers markets, that's the time when you make more money than the rest of the year, you know? So if I can make proper money in December, and I've got quite a lot of stock, so I'm fairly well placed to do all right for December and November and December. We'll see. But it's like the first full year that I've had in this unit. And so it's still a bit early to judge. But the thing is, because I've been doing it for 4 years, it feels like it's not too early to judge. But it is because of the nature of my product, I think, and the way that I'm going about doing it.
So I suppose in answer to the question, Andy doesn't know. He's right. North by Southwest is in its infancy and still has a long way to go before he can make his next move. Although, one thing Andy does know is, with the knowledge he has now, would he still have started North by Southwest?
As an ending question, this is kind of a classic, but if you have the knowledge you do now, would you do it again?
Yeah. I think I enjoy it. I don't enjoy it in some ways, but it's fundamentally cool. I still think it's cool. I still think it's interesting. I'm proud of what I make. But there are lots of disadvantages, and they are mainly lifestyle disadvantages, you know. And I've learned a lot of things that are worthwhile. And I've made loads of nice gear, and I've made quite a lot of nice contact. Like, there's a lot of, you meet a lot of people at these markets, you know, and they tend to be lovely. You know, it's a commercial transaction, but you're making friends with these people a little bit, you know, and that's cool as well, and that's worth it as well. But you know, if I were to make 3 times as much money as I do currently, then I would be delighted. Do you know what I mean? And but because I don't, it becomes, you know, difficult. And like, I've been asked that question before. This is perhaps not a very good ending to a podcast, but we did our kitchen in our house, right? And we saw on Grand Design some people make their own concrete worktops, okay, once. And then we were like, we want to have nice worktops, can't afford granite or marble, so fuck it, let's make some, buy a book on how to make concrete worktops. Tried for months and months to find that same episode of Grand Designs and failed. I've still never seen it again. I wonder if it really ever existed. And And then we made these concrete worktops with a joiner who came and did the kitchen, and he had to reinforce the units because it was so heavy. And they're normally on plastic sort of things, and like heavier than granite, because it's like way thicker than the granite. It's like thick, like it's over an inch thick. Then once you make them in like a sort of a mold shuttering, the hard work starts. And then you have to turn them out, put them in situ, polish them up. And like the amount of mess that it makes is insane. Like I did it in my back garden with a tent in the winter, with a tent over the top of it. And like I destroyed the grass, and like six people to turn it over and to put it in situ and whatever. And I also tiled the floor with some crazy expensive different tiles or whatever, which I'd never done before. And so if you asked me if I knew that kind of thing, I did that. And I was like, I mean, the kitchen looks really nice. Like it looks really nice. But the amount of work involved in it, if you asked me about that, if you knew what was involved, would you do it? The answer was no, definitely not. But with my business, it seems more satisfying. And I think the answer is yes. Maybe ask me in 3 years' time, you know, I might have a different answer. But yeah, it's worthwhile. It's interesting. And I think it's taken me at least to some places. Whether it'll take me all the way, we'll find out.
I suppose Andy's kitchen isn't getting redone anytime soon. However, it's good to know Andy finds value in his business outside of the finances. I think he enjoys his business because he gets to freely practice as he wants, to his individualistic desires, to his individualistic rules. This has always been Andy's way of living. And I suppose making sausages the way you want, e.g. properly, is the ultimate expression of this. I'm glad Andy has returned to Liverpool, as it means I can have his charcuterie on my doorstep. I'm also glad he's here, because it allowed me to meet him in situ at his curing unit and interview him. And in classic Andy fashion, I hope I did it properly.
Powered by Transmission Roundhouse.